WFSU FM now presents a delayed broadcast of the January 27, 2014 luncheon meeting of the Capital Tiger Bay Club. This program was recorded at the Donald L. Tucker Civic Center in Tallahassee. And now here's Capital Tiger Bay Club President Laurie Walker.
Today, we are honored to share a conversation with Judge Rosemary Barquette, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Florida, and recent U.S. appointee to the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal in The Hague. And if I could invite...
whatever that is.
Judge Barquette to our stage.
Yeah.
Judge Barquette. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You want me to sit in the middle?
Thank you.
Now, prior to her appointment, Judge Barquette served on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, an appointment she held since 1994. A graduate of Spring College and the University of Florida Law School, Judge Barquette. Nothing?
What can I say?
She worked in private practice in Florida and then served in numerous capacities on Florida state courts, including sitting as a justice and, of course, later as Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court, before her elevation to the federal bench. Judge Barquette has been an adjunct professor of law at Columbia Law School and Florida State College of Law, and is a member of the International Women's Forum and the American Society of International Law, where she serves on the Judicial Outreach Program Advisory. The United States Claims Tribunal was established pursuant to the Algiers Accords of January 19, 1981. It consists of 9 members, 3 appointed by the United States, 3 appointed by Iran, and the remaining 3 selected by another process. Now, to get the conversation started, joining Justice Barquette on stage today are Steve Sleppen.
Where are you going, sir?
Mr. Sleppen.
Oh.
Where am I sitting?
Anywhere you want, except not there. Here or there. Mr. Sleppen, Steve is former Tiger Bay president and chairman and has perfected a notorious reputation as a pestiferous questioner on the bench and at the bar during happy hour and after. And, of course, the highlight of his career was the day that he and his wife married me, and he was serving as the official photographer on Dog Island. So, thank you, Steve. Also joining us today as a panelist is Virginia Daly. She's a partner in the Florida-based law firm Hopping, Green & Sams, with a specialty in administrative law and litigation. She served as an adjunct professor at the FSU College of Law, lecturing in international law and international arbitration and dispute resolution. Before moving to Tallahassee, she practiced international law in London and Washington, representing foreign governments and entities in international tribunals in Geneva and The Hague. She's traveled extensively and worked with clients in the Czech Republic, Kuwait, Jordan, Sudan, and Ethiopia. Here in Tallahassee, many of us may know her as Commissioner John Daly's wife, Jenny, and she practices diplomacy on a daily basis as the wife of that commissioner. So thank you. Now, to open our dialogue, Justice Barquette has graciously offered to open the conversation by giving a brief overview about your current position and explaining the duties of the tribunal.
Thank you very much, Laurie.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much for having me. When I first came to Tallahassee in 1984, I think this was the first big official group I ever spoke in front of, and it was a real pleasure to be welcomed by all of you to what became my home for almost 20 years thereafter. So I appreciate very much coming back. I was not given the option of being interrogated at the bar. They just offered the luncheon, so here I am. But let me just briefly start off by telling you a little bit about the tribunal upon which I serve. I am not on the International Court of Justice, and I am not on the International Criminal Court, which the United States doesn't belong to anyway. I am not on the International Court of Justice for Yugoslavia or Rwanda or Lebanon, all of which exist elsewhere. I am on the United States, Iran, or it's really in reverse, the Iran-United States Claims Tribunal. It's a court that was established, as Laurie said, in 1980 when President Carter was president. And it was a vehicle by which we were able to obtain the release of the hostages that were not depicted in Argus. There were, if you recall, something like 59 members of the embassy that were taken during the revolution against the Shah, and we were very unsuccessful. I've had to reread a little bit of the history of all of that when I went to the court, and I found several things particularly fascinating. We apparently did try to rescue the hostages. We sent over something like 7 or 8 helicopters, several of which broke down, and we ultimately had to recall the helicopters because they didn't work, and had to find a different way to resolve the crisis. So with the help of Algeria, which brokered the agreement between the Iran and United States, they entered into a treaty which did 3 things, basically. Well, let me back up. Before the treaty and during the revolution, three basic things happened. They retained our hostages and kept them in Iran. And the United States then froze millions and billions of dollars in assets that it was able to gather that belonged to Iran. And at the same time, Iran, of course, during the revolution, appropriated tons of businesses and property that were owned by businesses all over the world, including very many United States companies. So the accords... Could I trouble somebody for a
sure.
Kleenex or a napkin and a glass of water? Thank
you. Of course.
The accords did 3 things. It provided for the release of the hostages, and it, on our part, required us to release the unfreeze the assets that we had frozen that belonged to Iran or Iranian companies, and it required Iran to also unfreeze and release properties that they had. But now we had all of this property, both in the United States and Iran, that was released or unfrozen, but how were you going to decide who it belonged to? So they established the tribunal so that people could make claims against the now unfrozen assets that existed in both Iran and the United States. The idea that this would be resolved in a few years turned out not to be the case. There's one other interesting sideline that let me just point out. Although Jimmy Carter was the president that worked through the original treaty agreement, the hostages were released the day President Reagan was inaugurated, if some of you might remember. And there was great debate then in the Reagan administration as to whether or not we should honor the agreement, because there was a lot of conversation about how it had been coerced because it was the way of getting our hostages back. So the Reagan Justice Department did a lot of research and conversation that went on back and forth, and a lot of people were arguing that we should sue in the world court to void the agreement because it had been obtained by coercion, in essence, because they had our hostages. And the Reagan Justice Department decided that they were not going to do that, and they were instead going to ratify the treaty. And why was that? I'm sure it had a lot to do with the fact that there would have been no other way for businesses to get back their property from Iran. And so it was ratified by both administrations, the Carter and the Reagan administration. During the next ensuing 20 years or so, parties throughout Iran and the United States have made claims. They have been resolved at the tribunal. I think I read an article that Jenny gave me that indicated some 600 to 800 claims have been resolved throughout the intervening years by the tribunal. And so the only thing that is left now is a very large claim by the country of Iran against the country of, against the United States as a country, because the treaty provides that the United States is obligated to transfer back to Iran any property that was owned by Iran. And the claim that is remaining consists of some 2,000 or so contracts that had been entered into by the Shah and the United States government, whereby we had agreed to sell to Iran some $30-40 million worth of military equipment, which obviously were not transferred after that. And so they, Iranians now want their money back, or maybe the equipment, I'm not exactly sure. But in any event, those claims total some significant sums of money, and they are the ones that are going to be heard now and that hopefully will be resolved. It takes a long time, and part of that has to do with this whole concept of arbitration. This is not exactly a court, although it sort of is. It's an arbitral tribunal, and in arbitration, a lot of this, a lot of the litigation is directed by the parties. So you have to wait till the parties agree when they're going to present the claims, when they're going to set up a hearing. And it isn't exactly like a court, which is, as those of you who know me in my legal prior capacity know, I was very big on expediting cases and trying to get them through the system. But this doesn't give you the ability to control that, and you are very much at the whim and will of the parties. So when people say this tribunal has been in existence so long, we had hearings scheduled, for example, in April. Iran withdrew their claims, and so that canceled the April hearings. Now we have to wait till May. So it's an interesting and very different process than the judicial one, and I'm still very much in transitional mode on a lot of levels, moving to The Hague, living there most of the time and returning to my home in Miami now part-time, and hopefully I'll continue to acclimate, and I'm finding it extremely fascinating and interesting to learn about a whole new area of law. Arbitration is a, as Jenny will tell you, is a fascinating and very complicated subject that we know really very little about in the judiciary, and I'm learning a lot about that. And one doesn't often get the opportunity at my age to start all over again and do something else. And so I feel extremely lucky, and I'll be happy to answer whatever questions you have about anything.
Jenny, let's start with you. In your extensive experience, what comes to mind that you'd like to ask Judge Barquette about?
Judge Barquette, I know you're still new and still finding your feet at the tribunal in The Hague, but do you notice any differences in the decorum of the participants and litigants and jurists between American proceedings and the international proceedings you've now joined?
Well, the disclaimer being that the only one I've ever had any experience with is this little tribunal that I'm on, so I don't know what goes on yet in the others, although I did attend the opening statement of the criminal trial where they are investigating charges against some of the Palestinians who have been accused of murdering former Prime Minister Hariri. So I did watch that. But in our tribunal, things are very, 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 very different than I'm used to. First of all, the decorum, that's perfectly fine. There are nine of us instead of seven or four or three. And the parties, the United States is represented by members of the State Department legal team. And there are four or five of them that sit on that side. and the Iranian government is represented by British lawyers. And they sit on the other side, and there's four or five of them. The first week was very different for me. It was in October, and they wanted a week to argue the legal issues involved in the factual claims that were going to be presented by testimony the following week. So we started at like 9:30 in the morning, and the lawyers for Iran started to talk, and they continued to talk for 2 hours. And they're not interrupted by questions. They just continue to make their presentation. Then another lawyer on their side gets up and starts talking about another issue in the case. In essence, everybody talked for the entire day. For those of you that have argued on the appellate courts here, you know you get 20 minutes. So you better figure out exactly what's important and say it. Partly, I think, because they don't get so much guidance from the court in terms of what the judges want to hear. And part of the reason for that is because there are nine of us and we're not too sure what the other guys want to hear. You may know what you want to hear. So without guidance, I think they assume that they need to make their case as clearly as possible. So they say the same thing four different ways, six different times, and it continues to go on like that. We take a break for lunch, and then we come back, and they continue talking till 6 o'clock. And so that is very different. We have Live Note, which is a real-time translation. So as they are, not only are they talking, but what they are saying is being transcribed as they speak. So if you do drift off, you can come back to figure out what it said. And, of course, it's, you know, it's fun to have the arguments made by somebody with a very interesting British accent. So it's different in that sense. It's also different in the sense that you do not have, we still haven't deliberated yet in the six or eight claims that we heard in October. We're in the process of having one of the third, what they call the third world arbitrators draft a set of issues which will be circulated, and then everybody will comment on it, at which point, theoretically, I think, we will sit down and debate or discuss the issues that have arisen, which are very different and very complex in a way that you may not have anticipated, because the Iranian judges might ask a question, for example, that you would have thought not particularly relevant, or the German judge might think that French law should apply to this particular transaction instead of Iranian or American law. And so it becomes a very interesting opportunity to kind of see the law from a different perspective. Those are the things that, off the top of my head, seem to me to be very different from what I've experienced in the United States courts.
Steve?
First, let me thank you for making it very clear that the tribunal is more important than the vermiform appendix. but secondly, taking you, if I may, in a direction which I think should be congenial to you and is important to, I think, there's a general misunderstanding as to what it means by a judge judging, particularly at the appellate level, which you've had vast experience in both at the state and federal level. Everyone comes to the bench in a political process of one sort or another, has values and political views, and it would be interesting for you to explain what judicial presuppositions or norms you brought to the bench and whether or how they changed over a period of time.
That's such a hard question to answer, because I'm not sure when you get appointed to the bench that you really think in terms of norms that you're bringing to the bench. I think it's a process that you develop as you read cases. I mean, people have this idea, and maybe it's true in some cases, but in the vast majority of cases, I think people are appointed to the bench by members of either party. I mean, let's set aside the people that you think might qualify as ideologues or that, or jerks or whoever, depending on whatever side you're on, and take the vast majority of people who just want to do public service or lawyers, and they get appointed to the bench. Most of those lawyers have not really thought about the way our government works and the place of the judiciary in it and the constitutional amendments and how they work in real life. If I were to give a test to the lawyers here who maybe practiced municipal law or real estate law or even litigation of tort law or something, and ask them to tell me about the difference between the Fifth Amendment right to counsel and the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, I would be willing to wager, and I understand now there's a place you can wager nearby in Tallahassee, that they may not be able to tell you. And so you become a judge, and you start reading these cases, and you're presented with constitutional questions, and you begin to read the prior precedent that affects those cases as it relates to a particular constitutional principle. And you begin to develop a view of, well, yeah, that sounds right to me, or that doesn't. And so you begin to say, where do individual rights fit in my understanding of our democracy? Do we give them all up and say we get them back because the group decides which ones to give us, or do we start out keeping the ones we have and preclude the group from taking them away? And so that's a process which is ongoing. If you were to ask me which one I believe in, I fall in the camp that says groups of whatever nature are going to represent who belongs to them and have a tendency to exclude those who do not. And so I start out with the proposition that the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence articulates, and that is that we are born simply by virtue of the fact that we are born, that we are individuals that have inalienable rights to do many different things, but certainly one of them is to participate in whatever group we're part of or find ourselves in, that we cannot be discriminated against because of who we are or what we are, and so on and so forth, and that therefore the job of the judiciary, and there's a lot of writings to support this, the job of the judiciary is to prevent government or other groups to violate the rights that the Constitution and that we have by virtue of being human beings.
Okay.
That's the best I can do. Thank you.
Now, I want to encourage our Tiger Bay members in the audience to, if you have questions, we will be looking to you to ask those throughout this dialogue. So if you have questions, the mic is in the middle of the room. Judge Barquette, while our member is getting ready, I would like to follow up on that a little bit.
Sure.
And ask you about the whole concept of appointing judges versus electing judges. Is that
I mean, every system, first of all, there is no system that is perfect, and I am sure that there may be problems with the appointed system, but the elected system is ridiculous. I mean, you cannot, it sounds good to say that you make yourself accountable to the public by way of elections, but the idea of letting people become judges because they have more money than the other candidate, or permit them to say perhaps things which are popular but which have nothing to do with an analysis of their legal competency, seems to me to be very ridiculous. And I have to tell you, I've lectured and conversed with judges and lawyers all over the world, especially in the Middle East and elsewhere, and they always bring this up and say, how can you people say that your judges aren't political if they run for office, and you know, you always say, well, because we can say that, and I don't know what else you say. So I don't think it's a good system. That is not to say that the appointive system is perfect, as you've seen. It too has its politics, but it seems to me it's a better system. And the idea that we had, I don't know if we still have it, I hope we do, where a committee of neutral people who care about justice and not just a particular point of view examine candidates to determine that they are indeed competent and suggest names of competent people to the appointing body for appointment still seems to be a better one than election, in my view.
Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
I was wondering if your tribunal's work is being complicated at all by the discussions in Washington about sanctions on Iran in connection with their nuclear program.
Yes, it is. It's not because of the conversations in Washington right now. It's the whole concept of sanctions, which has an effect because, for example, shortly after I got there, there was I'm even wondering if I'm supposed to be. Don't repeat this outside this room. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much you're supposed to say about this or not. But the sanctions have make it difficult in some instances for banks to do business with Iran, and that means that the money that the tribunal is funded. I am not a State Department employee. I do not work for the United States government. I work for the tribunal. The tribunal is funded by half the funds come from the U.S. and the other half come from Iran. And so it's a joint fund that funds all of the staff on the tribunal. And sometimes during the years, there have been banks that have had problems and advised Iran that they no longer want to maintain do business with them because of the sanctions, make it hard or something like that. And then there's a deal about trying to find another bank, and then they're behind on their payments, then they make it up, and now everybody's current. So in that sense, I think sanctions do have some effect, but it is part of the reason, I have to be very honest with you, when I first was approached about this, I was very hesitant to leave the court. I feel a great responsibility to whatever voice I can bring that's different from somebody else's voice to the issues that the 11th Circuit hears, and so I didn't really want to go. But on the other hand, as I said, you don't often get the chance to do something like this. It's the kind of thing that, Ginny did in her 20s that I wish I had done in my 20s so I get a chance to do it in my 70s. But part of the reason that enticed me was Harold Coe saying to me, it is the only entity, and this is before the president was beginning to talk to Iran, it's the only entity where Iran and the United States work together in a rule of law context. And they do work together. I sit with Iranian, with the three Iranian judges all the time and have conversations with them. So that was kind of an interesting sidelight to me. Yes, ma'am.
Recently, I was part of an informal session or a group, and two participants. One was a Nobel laureate, and the other was an attorney. And the issue they were discussing was, what is the responsibility of a judge? Is it to get at the truth, or is it to uphold the law? And I've always wanted to ask that question. To a judge.
Pretty dichotomous, isn't it?
The theoretical answer is that by getting at the truth, you are upholding the law. The practical answer, as you well know, is that that isn't always the case. The accoutrements of a trial are all designed so that you get at the truth. That's why we have cross-examination. That's why it always irritates me when people talk about people being let off on a technicality. I mean, the Constitution is not a technicality, and it was not designed for that one case or that one guy that might benefit from a rule. It was designed to protect an entire civilization, because when you say you don't want the police breaking down your door without a warrant, what you're saying is this is the kind of society we want, and we think it's important enough that if a policeman does this knowing he's doing that, that we cannot let that stand. There may be other ways to make sure that that is protected, but so far that's the way we've chosen to protect that Fourth Amendment right. So sometimes the rules are designed to protect the principles that ultimately are designed to get at the truth. Sometimes that doesn't happen. And in those cases, you just have to console yourself with the concept that in principle, the theory works. And in principle, it's a great system. And if it falls down sometimes, as any structure will, or as any human being will, or as any institution will, you have to take that and say it isn't perfect, but it's the best that we can do right now, and we will continue to try to fix it and make it better. So I don't know what else
Jenny,
to say.
Jenny, you had a question?
Yes, Justice Barquette, I wanted to follow up on the comment you made to Mr. Slepin about others, groups and others. And I'm curious, I understand that your parents are from Syria.
Yes.
And I'm curious whether your thoughts about groups and others have been influenced by that background.
Probably. Yes, I don't know. It's so hard to know what ultimately influences people. I mean, I know people who think exactly like I think, who had a very straightforward upbringing by two American parents who didn't have the benefit or the opportunity, whatever you want to call it, of living in a sort of a tricultural childhood, which is what I had. My parents, as many of you know, were born and raised and married in Syria. They were approximately 19 and 15 or something like that when they tried to come to the United States and ended up in Mexico. They had an arranged marriage. My mother came home at 14 and into a party that was being held where when she inquired as to the nature of the party, was told it was her engagement party. And it was like, to whom? That guy over there. However, they had many, many children, and they lived together 76 years, and they died 18 days apart. And so it seemed to have worked, at least in their case. When they got to Mexico, they tried to come to this country and were unsuccessful because of a quota system. So my father and mother started to work there. They had lots of children, myself included, in Mexico. And so they spoke Arabic to one another. We came to this country when I was about 5 or 6. They spoke Arabic to one another and my elder siblings, and then they also spoke Spanish to us, and then we were young enough to immediately learn English. My sisters still speak with a slight accent, not much anymore, my older sisters, but we do not. And so having the opportunity to have experienced all of that, I suppose, makes me see people as pretty much the same all over. But I don't know I've traveled now all over the world and taught and been exposed to different people, and it just seems like regardless of your own background, your education and your reading will tell you that most people have the same issues. They have the same stupid prejudices, and they have the same stupid meanness about some things, and they have the same wonderful generosity and goodness. So I've never understood, and I don't know why that is, but I've never understood people being ugly to other people because of their color or their religion or their sexual orientation or anything of that kind. I don't get it. I've never gotten it, and I don't know why I don't get it. I hope nobody else gets
We're glad you don't.
Either. Thank you. Anyway, yes, sir.
Yes, thank you so much. Your remarks are marvelous. I've got a question of the conceptual base of the U.S. court system versus Sharia law and international law. It seems to me that 85% of our law is contractually based and kind of works from that. How would you contrast the system we've got here with European and Sharia law and the way they conduct themselves in other international venues?
I'm still trying to work through that, to tell you the truth, and I'm finding it I'm finding it difficult. And the interesting to sort it all out. We give speeches. I participate in the American Bar Association's Rule of Law programs all over the world, and a lot of the rhetoric that occurs everywhere, it doesn't matter where. I've participated in a seminar in Qatar where all the people on that particular program were in robes or in partial burqas, and they were talking about the rule of law the same way we would be talking about the rule of law here, and it makes you wonder, well, what rule of law are we talking about here? And I mean, sometimes the rule of law has to do with, like, okay, you have to obey what I say. Well, that's why we shouldn't be talking about the rule of law. We should be talking about a system that protects minority rights and that provides access to the participatory government. And I'm not sure Sharia law, you know, does that. But this is the culture in all of these places, and I don't know exactly. And I think they're struggling too, a lot, because there are women in Egypt who feel disenfranchised, but who are very religious, and they're trying to work out how all of that works together in some way. I will leave you with on that question, which like has been totally incomprehensible, my answer. I apologize.
No, that's fine.
But yeah, it's hard to get a handle on all of that because it's happening all over the world where there is this conflict and this attempt at sorting it out and making it work together. But I will leave you with this. And not being on the court system, I now feel a little bit greater freedom in saying things like this. I mean, I hope that people can understand now in this country how important it is to keep church and state separate. I have seen opinions, you know, come out where we've said, no, you can't pray in schools or whatever have you, and there's all this huge annoyance with the opinion, and you try to point out what the ramifications of going the other way would be, and I think your question clearly points out what the ramifications would be if in this country we said it was perfectly all right to let government decide that you can pray however you want to, but if it's Sharia law, for example, that becomes the majority rule. Is that what one wants if one doesn't practice that particular religion? I just think that more than anything indicates how important it is to preserve everybody's individual religious rights, but at the same time not to impose anybody's religious rights on anybody else that doesn't want them imposed.
Thank you very much.
Allow me to draw you back to domestic shores, if
okay.
I may. At last reading, there's nothing in the Constitution of the United States about Monroe Street or red hats or noontime. But based upon your experience, would your personal opinion be that I have some kind of a constitutional right to wear a red hat on Monroe Street at noontime?
I think this is a trick question. Clearly, it has to be a trick question. Do you? No, I don't. But I think you can wear a red hat on Monroe Street at noontime. time. If you're asking me if I think that means that you can also wear religious symbols in a government building, I don't know.
No.
No.
No, that's the next question.
Yes, I think you can wear what you want to in a private place. I mean, in a commercial place, in a non-governmental place.
On the sidewalk.
On the sidewalk. Maybe not in the street where you might distract the...
No, certainly.
All right. Although if I saw you in a red hat, I might be distracted.
Oh, I would hope
regardless
so.
Regardless of where you
Thank
were standing.
You.
Okay, we have another question.
First, I want to say, Your Honor, I got to hear you in 1984. And
oh, my God.
I don't remember what you said, but I remember that I was very excited because I was... I was much younger than I am now.
As was I.
Yeah. I want to follow up on what the gentleman said. He kind of stole my question, I think, but he used more exact wording than I do. In your arbitration role, I know...
That's the joke.
If I'm understanding that correctly, even... I know the United States has our constitution and our rules and our culture and all these other countries. I'm presuming there's more than one arbitration group going on around the world. And I'm wondering, do you have rules of procedure that that take all of those other countries' constitutions and
yes.
rules of operations
Yes,
and
that's a really interesting question. First of all, every entity has its own rules and regulations. In this country, ours is the Constitution, all the rules and regulations that we have developed over the years as part of our case law and our statutes. In a tribunal such as mine, however, the only thing that guides us is the treaty itself. And so we have to look to the treaty. In looking to the treaty, sometimes there is confusion about what we apply international law. But sometimes, for example, on the question, I think I mentioned the treaty provides that the United States must transfer assets that were owned by Iran. And so now a question has arisen in the tribunal, what does owned by Iran mean? Mm-hmm. In one case, it was the Stradivarius that was mentioned. The Shah of Iran gave a Stradivarius to a guy, and it was purchased in Paris for $250,000 in 1976, and he kept it, and they say it belongs to them, and he should have returned it. And so then the question becomes, did they own it when they say they loaned it to him? He says they gave it to him. There's some dispute about it. So does the law of France apply because that's where it was purchased? Does the law of Iran apply? Or because he's now in the United States, does the law of the United States apply? So it's a combination. The rules and regulations of a tribunal are whatever is the governing document of that tribunal, and that can be different things. I'm sure Ginny can talk about the rules and regulations of the ICJ, which are developed by the United Nations and the court itself. The World Court, as it's also called, has something like, 89 judges or something like that from every country in the world, and they had to develop their own rules. So it's really a complex answer to your question. Everybody has their own rules. There are, in arbitration, there are hundreds of arbitral bodies. There are some that only deal with arbitration relating to labor disputes. And they have their own rules.
Right.
What I would have considered ordinary arbitrations, the arbitrations I knew about before I got this job, the American Arbitration Association has its rules. And so it depends on where you are and what you're arbitrating and what you're doing as to which rules apply.
Ginny, do you have a follow-up question?
Sure. And Justice Barquette, you're correct. The development of those procedural rules for the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal themselves were some of the more contentious developments in the early days of that tribunal. Do you see in continuing procedural issues that are arising? Are you now at a position where the tribunal is mature enough to focus on substantive legal issues?
I'm not sure. I haven't been there long enough, mm-hmm. but maybe you'll have me back in a year and I'll let you know more. Yes.
Justice Barquette, the last time we did this, you were the one asking the questions. I don't think the answers were very good. My question, threefold, does the court have a definite lifespan? What is your estimate of how long it will take to resolve all the remaining cases? And must you be a member of the court to practice before?
That's a good question.
Must you be a member of the...
Of the tribunal.
To do what?
To practice or appear before it.
Like no.
You have to be a member of the 11th Circuit.
You have to be hired. No. Let me take the last question first. You have to be hired by the party to represent them. So Iran hires their lawyers, whoever. Anybody can be hired by them. The United States uses State Department lawyers who have been working on this case for 20 years. They are very intimately familiar with it. So you don't have to be, there's no such thing as like being a member of the 11th Circuit or something like that. The how long it's going to be is unclear. There are constant rumors that it could be resolved by agreement within the next 2 or 3 years. If the claims that are in existence go forward, it would probably take another 4 or 5 years. But I don't know.
Thank
or
you.
They could settle the whole thing tomorrow, in which case I'd be
now
out of
a job
again.
Now that George has pointed out that the shoe is on the other foot and you're answering the questions, tell me, who are the other nine that are on the court, and how did you get there in the first place?
I know, isn't it? I don't know. I do know. There are three members of the tribunal that are from the United States. One, his name is Charles Brower. He's been on the tribunal for many, many years. He was on the tribunal at the beginning, and then he got off of it, and then he got back on it. The other is, his name is Tom Johnson. He's from Washington, D.C. And then me. There are, I'll come back to how I got on it in a second. The three Iranians, I don't know how they get picked. I was told that these are three relatively new ones. An opinion came out that lost a case, and the other three guys left, and then three new ones came in. But I don't know if that's related or not. So there are three Iranians. One of the Iranians used to be on the Iran Supreme Court, but their Supreme Court is different than ours. I think they have like 50 members, so I'm not clear, but he used to be a judge. I can't give you the backgrounds of the other two off the top of my head, but you can get it on the website that we have. And then, theoretically, the two groups picked third-party arbitrators from other countries. And this was all done before I got there. There are two from Germany, and the president of the tribunal is from Belgium. And I have a sense that the two sides argue sort of to the middle, and maybe, and then it gets, you know, and that's kind of the way things run for a little bit. Judge McDonald, Gabriella McDonald, who used to be a federal district judge in Texas, was my predecessor. She became ill and retired from the tribunal, and I just got a call out of the blue from one of the arbitrators, Charles Brower, whom I knew, and he said, you know how you always keep asking what you should do when you grow up? I've got another suggestion for you. And as I said, at first I said no, and then I got a call from Harold Coe, who had been the legal advisor under Hillary Clinton, who urged me to do this, and then talked to some other people. And I don't know how my name came up. I think it's one of those things where people say we have to find somebody, and then somebody says, oh, I know somebody, da-da-da-da, and it goes sort of like that, I think.
Steve, did you have a final question?
So you didn't have to draw the short straw.
No. No, I think I got a pretty long straw. I think it's just a fascinating opportunity, really.
This is my last chance to bring you back to domestic judicial matters.
I wanted his question.
No, we'll get his.
Yeah.
No, I'm only joking. Whatever.
No, we don't want his question.
You had a bunch of questions.
precedent.
Yes, sir.
We hear a lot of talk about precedent.
Yes.
Could you, can anyone, but can you in this case give a brief statement of what we mean by precedent, and then in your capacity, several capacities on the appellate courts, how you weighed that, what consideration you gave to that, how obligatory was it?
Well, first of all, it's very obligatory, and anybody that tells you it's not is wrong. I mean, it's very obligatory. If there is a case on point, and this is a, something that distinguishes our system from many others. China, for example, they don't have precedent. They don't have written opinions. But if you have an opinion from your court or the Supreme Court or a higher court of any nature, and it clearly establishes that the result in this case has to be this, you have to follow it, whether you like it or not, whether you think it's right or not, whether you think it's moral or not, you have to follow it. So you have to follow precedent. Now, having said that, a lot of precedent is not very clear. There are many, many instances where there are two divergent lines from the same Supreme Court that will lead you in two different directions. So you have to try to analyze them. You have to try to harmonize them if you can. And if you can't, you have to decide which one is more applicable to your fact situation. At least that's the way, in my mind, analytically, you would go about it.
That's where the judging comes in.
That's where the judging comes in. That's right. That's right. Or in another situation where the direction of the precedent goes in one direction and you have a fact pattern that doesn't quite fit it, then you have to judge and decide whether you want that to go in this direction or in that direction. And that's where it plays out consistently with your view of government and individual rights and everything else.
Jeff, final question.
Thank you. Justice, would you mind sharing some of your highs and lows from your time on the Florida Supreme Court, what challenges the court may face, and more importantly, do you think it'll snow this week?
I hope not. I left The Hague where they said it was going to snow, and I was thinking I was coming to sort of warmer Tallahassee, but I don't know. Highs and lows, gosh.
And you're the first woman justice.
The journey, the trip, the whatever you want to call it, of having had the opportunity that I had to be here. When I first came to Tallahassee, I was of course, you know, extremely nervous. I was young. I didn't know anybody. I mean, I knew people, but not really, really. Every court you leave, and I've left lots of them and moved on, you go to the next court and you think, geez, how wonderful the one you was before that you thought wasn't so great when you were on it. And having gone through a lot of them, I really think my time on the Florida Supreme Court was one of the best court times. I hate to say that because I love West Palm Beach too and my trial court. First of all, the highs was I was welcomed so unbelievably warmly by the members of the Supreme Court. And I wasn't sure that was going to be the case. I mean, we had, I was 45 or something, 43, and there were a lot of like guys who were a little bit older than that. Jimmy Adkins was from the Cedar Key area, Levy County, and Joe Boyd, and I thought, oh, what are they going to think? I'm a woman. I am relatively young, and I was nervous. And they couldn't have been more welcoming. I did think it was. I don't know whether this constitutes a high or not exactly. I had an interesting, very Southern meal, which I had not really ever been exposed to quite in the same way at B.K. Roberts' home. It was, that was kind of interesting. But the the court itself became very familial to me. We used to have we had conference every week, and anybody that wanted to put a case on the conference schedule could do so. So that if you saw an opinion that you had a question about, you just marked it to go to conference, and then the seven of us would sit and talk about it or argue about it. And we had some really loud arguments on occasion, but because we were together for so long, after a few years, it was like literally your brothers and sisters, and you could yell and scream and then everybody would be fine afterwards. They'd pick you up to take you to the ball game or to the whatever. Lyndon, you know, I shouldn't be telling you this story. Lyndon Larry ought to be telling you this story. Lyndon Larry Abel lived a few blocks away, and they got me started running. We would run every morning at 5:15. They would swing by and pick me up, and we would run for 3 miles or so. And they heard more stuff about what was going on. That I can't believe they are. But in its totality, I just think I was very lucky to serve with a whole bunch of people who tried really hard to get things right and to do things for the right reasons and not to be, and to listen to one another a lot of the time. I mean, it's hard because you come with your own views. So in that sense, it was very much a high to serve on that court. Tallahassee was wonderful to me. I had to run, I made Gail Nelson take me to Barnacle Bill's for steamed oysters and beer yesterday. The St. Mark's Trail, living here was really great. Working with the legislature in those days was wonderful. I mean, we would all go to the same parties and have our big discussions. People that were supposed to be not exactly hostile, but not like on the same page you were, like Bob Butterworth was the attorney general, and you could go to a party and he would have appealed one of the cases you had written, and you'd say, "You're such a jerk for doing that," and he could laugh back at you and send you a funny note about it. It was, I remember it as a time of great attempt to, I don't know, do the people's business in each of our separate departments in a meaningful way. I loved my whole time in Tallahassee, and I'm very grateful for it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know. Personally, I have pages of questions. We'd love to have a longer conversation. Unfortunately, our meeting is limited in time. I would love for you to come back and for you to start that book so that we can all share the inside story. And thank you, Tiger Bay members, for your great questions and for making this dialogue so interesting for all of us. Thank you, Judge Barquette.
You've been listening to a delayed broadcast of the January 27th, 2014 luncheon meeting of the Capital Tiger Bay Club. This program was recorded at the Donald L. Tucker Civic Center in Tallahassee. Join us again next time for another luncheon meeting of the Capital Tiger Bay Club on WFSU-FM.